British Sky Broadcasting, in association with Warner Independent Pictures, presents Good Night and Good Luck, starring David Strathairn as Edward R. Murrow and George Clooney as Fred Friendly. Also starring Robert Downey Jr., Patricia Clarkson, and Frank Langella. The jazz singer is Diane Reeves. The film, shot in black and white, is directed by George Clooney. The audio description is by Tony Cook on behalf of the MCS agency. Guests in dinner jackets and evening dresses sit in animated conversation at small tables decorated with lamps and flowers. Glasses of champagne rest on the tables. There are many smiles as they demonstrate a feeling of friendship, familiarity, and intimacy. They all look well-heeled and well-fed. Many smoke cigarettes. There's an air of expectancy as they comfortably chatter among themselves. A man in specs holds a box camera and signals for a group of the guests to line up for a photograph. After taking the picture, he passes the camera to a smiling middle-aged woman in a low-cut dress with sparkling earrings and a matching bracelet. He takes the woman's place in the lineup, resting his hands on the shoulders of two others. A flashbulb goes off as the woman takes a second picture. One of the men applauds. A caption reads, "Good night and good luck." Next, a man addresses the audience from a podium on the stage. At his side, a screen shows slides.
In 1935, Ed Murrow began his career with CBS. When World War II broke out, it was his voice that brought the Battle of Britain home to us through his This Is London radio series. He started with us all, many of us here tonight, when television was in its infancy with the news documentary show See It Now. He threw stones at giants. Segregation, exploitation of migrant workers, apartheid, J. Edgar Hoover, not the least of which, his historical fight with Senator McCarthy. He is the host of our enormously popular show, Person to Person, and tonight he is here with his son, Casey, wife, Janet, and all of you who he's worked with, inspired, lectured, and taught. Ladies and gentlemen, the Radio Television News Directors Association and Foundation welcomes Mr. Edward R. Murrow.
In the wings, Murrow takes a final drag on his cigarette and walks onto the stage, holding a script and blowing out the smoke. He shakes hands with the man who introduced him. As he waits at the podium, looking a little uneasy, flashbulbs go off. The slide screen says a salute to Edward R. Murrow, October the 25th, 1958.
This might just do nobody any good. At the end of this discourse, a few people may accuse this reporter of fouling his own comfortable nest, and your organization may be accused of having given hospitality to heretical and even dangerous ideas. But the elaborate structure of networks, advertising agencies, and sponsors will not be shaken or altered. It is my desire, if not my duty, to try to talk to you journeymen with some candor about what is happening to radio and television. And if what I say is responsible, I alone am responsible for the saying of it. Our history will be what we make of it. And if there are any historians about 50 or 100 years from now, and there should be preserved the kinescopes of 1 week of all three networks, they will there find, recorded in black and white and in color, evidence of decadence, escapism, and insulation from the realities of the world in which we live. We are currently wealthy, fat, comfortable, and complacent. We have a built-in allergy to unpleasant or disturbing information. Our mass media reflect this. But unless we get up off our fat surpluses and recognize that television, in the main, is being used to distract, delude, amuse, and insulate us. Then television and those who finance it, those who look at it, and those who work at it, may see a totally different picture too late.
The caption reads, CBS Studios, New York, October the 14th, 1953. A smartly dressed man removes his hat and makes way for two chatting women who enter a lift. He gives a courteous smile and gets in the lift after them. A caption reads, throughout the 1940s and 1950s, America was overwhelmed with concerns about the threat of communism. Senator Joseph McCarthy made a public accusation that more than 200 card-carrying communists had infiltrated the United States government. Few in the press were willing to stand up against McCarthy for fear that they too would be targeted. Now the two women make their way from the lift along a corridor. As Millie is summoned, the other woman peers through the door of a studio where a wholesome black lady sings with a band.
Talk about the Roy Campanella piece.
All right, give me about a half an hour.
Half an hour? No, I'm maybe a little
quicker. Can I get a cup of coffee first?
Please, come on. Oh, get me this.
The newsroom complex.
Morning, Johnny.
I have some new notes that go with the Tito
Fred. Of course you
Fred.
Do. Fred's not going to be in for about an hour.
I understand. I already put him on his desk.
Okay.
Can you just make sure that he doesn't look at the film until he reads the notes? Thank you. Hey, Joe, Shirley.
Remarkable.
Hey.
John.
What's going on in here?
What do you mean?
Two attractive people alone in the copy room.
Well, don't tell Paley, he'll fire me.
Both of us, Shirley. Fire
both. Always say, rules are made to be broken.
You can afford to say that.
Shirley takes a piece of paper from Joe's hand. She steps towards a stack of filing cabinets.
It's simply a loyalty oath.
To CBS?
And to America.
You promise to be a loyal American?
All the reporters have signed this.
Who are you promising this to?
A friend
CBS?
Signed it. Murrow
Paley?
Signed it. Murrow signed it.
Murrow signed it? Are you now, or have you ever been?
It was a joke at first, but there's a lot of pressure.
That appeared on the Attorney General's list of subversive groups.
I don't know. I don't.
All right, let's think about it. What is it really saying? Is it a civil liberties issue or censorship?
I'm simply stating to CBS that I'm not a communist. That's fine.
Murrow signed this.
Yeah, and Fred himself.
Well, maybe you should talk to Murrow.
Maybe I should sign it.
If you don't sign this, are you and I a target?
If I don't sign it, they'll fire me.
They hold each other's gaze. She leans in and kisses him on the lips.
Well then, finally we can tell everyone the truth.
If I could express it in what's in my heart right now, I'd do it in the terms of the poet who once said, "Ah, 'tis but a dainty flower I bring to you. Yes, 'tis but a violet, glistening with dew. But still in its heart there lie beauties concealed. So in our heart, our love for you lies unrevealed." You know, I used to...
The production team study a screen in the viewing room.
Pride myself on the idea that I was a bit tough, especially over the past 18 or 19 months when we've been kicked around and bullwhipped and damned. I didn't think that I could be touched very deeply.
Okay, that's enough. That's enough, Leo.
Short, man.
How long is the piece?
It's about right now, Millie.
It's about 4 minutes now, but we can cut it down.
You know, I can't stand alone, but it might be a nice companion piece.
All right,
let's go through this one more time. Palmer?
Yeah, got a call from the office of Senator Morse this morning. Interested in setting up a debate, possibly with Senator Kerr, over some of the comments Benson made on last night's show.
Secretary of Agriculture. I think that's a good idea. Can they do it by this week?
No, it'd have to be 2 weeks at the earliest, depending on Morse's schedule, but still think it's a great idea.
Let's follow up on that. The Hoover speaks on Benjamin Franklin piece.
Well, we're having better luck with Mr. Benjamin Franklin than we are with Mr. Hoover.
It may progress Schroeder. Better as a person-to-person.
Mm. At home with Ben Franklin, his electricity
no, we've got
award.
The footage. They just need to contact him. We got to get
see if you can get in touch with him and get the shot. He wants to do the story. Joe?
Remember Delbert Clark? No
yeah.
longer with us.
New York Times?
Oh, no, yeah,
right,
I
our
that.
Friend at the Times, yeah.
What's
this is yesterday morning. They're saying it's...
How old is he?
53, illness, sudden
why?
Illness, home of a friend.
No, it's not an Ovid piece. Natalie, send some flowers over there from the CBS.
A couple things. Case before the Supreme Court involving the constitutionality of a section of the Internal Security Act.
provides for the deportation of any alien if he becomes a communist after entering this country. You take this? All right. McCarthy interrupting his wedding trip to take charge of the investigation of communist infiltration.
Natalie Sensenflower.
Poor Mrs. McCarthy.
May I finish?
This is national security.
Huh? Real ladies, man.
Well, they're in love.
They're in love. Yeah.
We have no show for Tuesday, fellas, so get out there and make some news. Rob a bank, mug an old lady, do something.
You guys look at the Secretary of Stevens' footage?
We will, John.
Watch all the way to the end. It's worth it.
Thank you, John.
There's not much there. I can tie it to the Eisenhower in the back of the train piece.
You ever spend any time in Detroit, Fred?
Not recently.
There's a story here in the Detroit News in Dexter, Michigan. A kid named Milo Radulovich.
Italian?
Irish. Air Force kicked him out because his dad read some Serbian newspaper.
His dad a communist?
I don't know.
He brought the charges.
Air Force. Charges were in a sealed envelope. Nobody saw them.
Not even at the hearing?
He was declared guilty without a trial and told if he wanted to keep his job, he had to denounce his father and his sister. Thank you, Natalie.
His sister?
He told him to take a hike. Let's send Joe and Charlie down there, see if he's any good on camera.
Is he being brought before the committee?
No.
It's not McCarthy.
Isn't it?
Morrow and producer Fred Friendly exchange an intense glance.
Milo Radulovich.
The interview, October the 19th, 1953.
What happens to your children, then, as your five-year-old and your five-month-old in terms of you?
Yes, if I am being judged on my relatives, if are my children going to be asked to denounce me, are they going to be judged on what their father was labeled? Are they going to have to explain to their friends, etc., why their father is a security risk? If the thing is let stand, as if the first recommendation was sent out by the board, I see a chain reaction that has no end to anybody, for anybody.
The deputy chief, Frank Stanton, is with Morrow and Fred Friendly.
Well, that's new. I don't think you can call this a neutral piece.
Well, the other side's been represented rather well for the last couple of years.
To the Air Force,
so
they haven't gone on the record.
To forego the standards you've stuck to for 15 years? Both sides, no commentary.
We all editorialize. It's
just making sure we identify what it is you're
doing. Giving them
the
information up front, and we're asking them to comment on it.
Fred, hold on, Fred. I've searched my conscience, and I can't for the life of me find any justification for this. And I simply cannot accept that there are, on every story, two equal and logical sides to an argument. Call it editorializing if you'd like.
It is editorializing.
They're going to have equal time to defend themselves.
Do you understand the position you're putting us in?
We are all in this together. If the Senate wants to investigate...
Do me this favor, Fred. Avoid any big speeches about how we're all in a big boat together, okay? Please don't insult me. I have to go back to Mr. Paley and Alcoa, who sponsors your show, and also happens to have some military contracts, and I have to tell them that they're going to be in a bit of a tough bind because of a beef you had with Joe McCarthy.
We're not going at McCarthy.
Well, you're starting the goddamn fire.
Excuse me, gentlemen. Mr. Friendly, there's a Colonel Anderson to see you.
Colonel?
Yeah, he's in your office.
All right.
There's two of them.
Maybe they like the transcript and want to compliment us on it. Excuse me.
Friendly leaves Stanton and Morrow staring at each other in the office. Stanton shakes his head.
Go after Joe Kennedy. We'll pay for it.
I've got a great story about Hoover.
You know how many person-to-persons you're going to have to do to make up for this?
Judy and her daughter Liza next week.
No, no, no. You're interviewing Rin Tin Tin. I'll talk to Mr. Paley. Alcoa won't pay for the ads. And we probably won't either. But nobody will stop you.
How much are the ads?
$3,000.
I'll split it with Fred. He just won't have Christmas presents for his kids this year.
He's a Jew.
Well, don't tell him that. He loves Christmas.
Morrow follows him from the office looking anguished. Friendly sits with two poker-faced colonels in uniform.
To be clear, you did speak with the lawyers.
Yes, we did. And we read the transcript. We've not been allowed to see the footage.
We're still shooting it. Charlie Mack is on a plane from Dexter, Michigan right now with the rest of the interviews. We'll be going right down
your to the show airs tomorrow. How can we possibly approve and check the story that you are running in the limited amount of time you have given us?
With all due respect, you have been invited to participate in this piece, not to approve this piece. We are going with a story that says that the U.S. Air Force tried Milo Radulovich without one shred of evidence and found him guilty of being a security risk without his constitutional rights.
And you, who also have not seen the evidence, are claiming he's not a security risk. Wouldn't you guess that the people who have seen the contents of that envelope might have a better idea of what makes someone a danger to his country? Or do you think it should just be you that decides?
Who are the people? Are they elected? Are they appointed? Do they have an axe to grind? Is it you, sir, or you, Colonel Jenkins? Do you know the contents of that sealed envelope?
Mr. Friendly, we have been a friend and ally of both Mr. Murrow and CBS News for many years. The story you are going to run tomorrow is without merit. So before you take any steps that cannot be undone, I strongly urge you to reconsider your stand. These are very dangerous waters you are attempting to navigate.
Friendly stares defiantly. Now more news footage with the caption, October the 20th, 1953.
As a matter of fact, we have had no hearing at all. We have had no day in court. In all the 32 years that I have been a practicing attorney in Detroit, I have never witnessed such a farce and travesty upon justice as this thing has developed. Now this whole
Eddie,
story...
Eddie, take the first reel. It's countdown. I left about 5 seconds
extra. Five seconds extra. I got it. Palmer, where's Joe? Have you seen Joe? We're going to have to do the voiceover live. Natalie, I need a booth with a live mic.
Booth
all right?
Is there.
We're going to have to do the voiceover live. We didn't have time to sync it up.
That's not what I asked.
Missing the voiceover.
5 seconds, that's too much.
Don, we need a commercial in the booth. What do you want me to do?
2 minutes there, Paul.
There's not supposed to be a commercial.
Get him out of the booth. Out of the booth.
Don, you can't do it on the ending.
2.5 minutes on the end.
2.5 minutes.
Hey, we got 3 minutes.
Also, fellas, keep it down, please. It's a little loud.
2 minutes there, fellas.
Both 2.5.
He's got an edit joke.
Make sure you also know that I swap out those two pieces of parents on the end with the
Well, as long as he talks fast.
He will talk fast.
Yeah.
Told Edmund.
Friendly crosses to the studio and puts on earphones.
We got the film.
Will it be ready?
You bet.
Friendly lights a cigarette for Morrow and squats down out of camera range.
Funny thing, Freddy. Every time you light a cigarette for me, I know you're lying.
In his pinstriped suit, Murrow makes adjustments to the script in front of him. He looks pensive as he plucks a flake of tobacco from his mouth.
You know, it occurs to me we might not get away with this one.
Friendly nods agreement. In the control room, the technical team sit in a row. Others stand behind them. All look apprehensive.
10 seconds.
You fellas ready?
Okay.
Ready on camera one.
Holding his cigarette, Morrow nervously adjusts his jacket as the seconds tick away to on airtime.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Friendly taps Morrow on the leg with his pen.
Good evening. A few weeks ago, there occurred a few obscure notices in the newspaper about a Lieutenant Milo Radulovich, a lieutenant in the Air Force Reserves, and also something about Air Force Regulation 35-62. That is a regulation which states that a man may be regarded as a security risk if he has close and continuing association with communists or people believed to have communist sympathies. Lieutenant Radulovich was asked to resign in August. He declined. A board was called and heard his case. At the end, it was recommended that he be severed from the Air Force, although it was also stated that there was no question whatever as to the lieutenant's loyalty. We propose to examine, insofar as we can, the case of Lieutenant Radulovich. Our reporter, Joe Wershba, cameraman, Charlie Mack.
This is the town of Dexter, Michigan, population 1,500.
This statue is at the end of...
Morrow to Friendly.
What did the general tell you yesterday?
It was a colonel, but there were two of them.
That makes a general.
You weren't too pleased.
You're going to get audited this year.
Not me, you. I told him I didn't want to do the story.
You always were yellow.
Better than red.
Morrow takes a deep drag on his cigarette and blows the smoke through his nose.
In 10 seconds.
Friendly cues him with another tap on the leg.
This is the sister, Margaret Radulovich Fishman. She neither defends nor explains her political activities.
I feel that my activities
Well, be they what they may, or my political beliefs are my own private affair.
If, are my children going to be asked to denounce me? Are they going to be judged on what their father was labeled? Are they going to have to explain to their friends, etc., why their father is a security risk? I see absolutely that this is a chain reaction. If the thing is let stand as if the first recommendation was sent out by the board, I see a chain reaction that has no end to anybody, for anybody.
Perhaps you will permit me to read a few sentences just at the end, because I would like to say rather precisely what I mean. We have told the Air Force that we will provide facilities for any comment, criticism, or corrections it may wish to make in regard to the case of Milo Radulovich. We are unable to judge the charges against the lieutenant's father or sister because neither we, nor you, nor they, nor the lawyers, nor the lieutenant know precisely what was contained in that manila envelope. Was it hearsay, rumor, gossip, slander, or hard ascertainable facts that could be backed by credible witnesses? We do not know. We believe the son shall not bear the iniquity of the father, even though that iniquity be proved, and in this case it was not. But we believe, too, that this case illustrates the urgent need for the armed forces to communicate more fully than they have so far done the procedures and regulations to be followed in attempting to protect the national security and the rights of the individual at the same time. Whatever happens in this whole area of the relationship between the individual and the state, we will do it ourselves. It cannot be blamed on Malenkov or Mao Zedong or even our allies. And it seems to us, that is, Fred Friendly and myself, that this is a subject that should be argued about endlessly. Good night and good luck.
And we're out.
Wild applause erupts in the control room. Joe Wershber, in his shirt sleeves, nervously fidgets with his ear, swept by a sense of relief and trepidation. In the studio, Murrow locks eyes with Friendly with a look of comradeship and foreboding. Friendly lights a cigarette for him with a warm nod of respect.
My eyes on you, so best beware.
Stanton strides along the shiny corridors to the executive suite, where he enters an office. In a studio, the jazz singer performs with her musicians.
My spies on you. I'm checking on all you do. From A.
Now a commercial break.
May I tell you something about yourself as a member of the person-to-person audience based on audience research studies? You are well above average in education and intelligence. Your interests are wide, from world affairs and science to sports and show business. And you have one characteristic that's rather encouraging to me, and that's the fact that you are not easily persuaded by advertising. Now, the makers of Kent considered all these characteristics when they chose Mr. Murrow's program to tell you about Kent. Of all leading filter cigarettes, Kent filters best. Now, if you'll try Kent with that in mind, I think you'll agree with many, many other thinking people who have changed to Kent. They find that it makes good sense to smoke Kent and good smoking, too.
Did you get the change on that? Okay.
Yeah, the lights are on.
Okay. No. Right, you there? Okay,
we got her.
Now back to Ed Murrow.
Not since the silent movies and the idols they produced has Hollywood witnessed the sort of pilgrimage that is now going on. Each day, oblivious to time, weather, and the state of the world, sightseers head in the direction of California's San Fernando Valley. For there, at the end of the tourist line, is Sherman Oaks, and the home Liberace has built for himself and his mother. This is the front, and nobody knows how many people have seen that view. This is the back of the house, and that's Liberace's bedroom. Good evening, Lee.
Good evening, Ed.
What are you doing?
Well, I'm just dictating my weekly syndicated newspaper column, and on my trusty tape recorder here, I also am dictating a book. It's an inspirational book that I'm working on right now.
Have you given much thought to getting married and eventually settling down?
Well, actually, I've given a lot of thought to marriage, but I don't believe in getting married just for the sake of getting married. I want to someday find the perfect mate and settle down to what I hope will be a marriage that will be blessed by faith and will be a lasting union. In fact, I was reading about lovely young Princess Margaret, and she's looking for her dream man, too, and I hope she finds him someday.
Uh-huh. Well, Lee, thanks very much for letting us come and visit you. It's been very pleasant. And will you say goodnight to the rest of your family for us?
I certainly would.
Thanks a lot.
Good night, Ed.
Good night, Lee. Next week, we'll take you to Beverly Hills, California, to the house of Mickey Rooney and his new bride. Until then, good night and good luck.
The CBS logo fills the screen.
Good show, Mr. Morrow.
Sitting in an easy chair in the studio, Morrow greets the compliment with a resigned sigh. As the studio crew shut down and the lights fade, he remains sitting deep in thought. He leans forward wearily in his chair before getting to his feet. The studio clock says 11 o'clock.
Excuse me, Mr. Morrow. When you have a moment, can you take a look at this and sign it for me? Thank you. Oh, and Dr. Stanton wanted to know if you could have a drink with him.
When?
Now. He's at the Pentagon Bar.
I can't. What the hell is he doing there?
I believe he's waiting for you.
Well, just call him, Natalie.
That's fine. I'll call
him. Oppenheimer next week. It's a good show, Ed.
Hey, Don.
Ed? Hey, you're getting good at this. They're going to think you like it.
Pays the bills. How are you, Don?
It's day to day.
Well, if she saw how good you looked right now, she'd be back.
You tell her that if you see her, will you?
Read the O'Brien piece.
Yeah, it's tough. I'm a pinko. I slant the news. I'm just waiting for him to say my wife left me, too.
Well, nobody worth their salt reads him.
You read him.
Well, see, I rest my case.
Does Paley read him?
Bill Paley's not going to do anything, Don. Huh.
Thanks, Ed. Oh, I just came by to tell you how great the lieutenant piece was.
Thanks.
How's the fallout?
Mostly good, surprisingly.
Is this the start? Are you taking sides?
It's just a little poke with a stick, see what happens.
You let me know if I can help.
But you're a pinko, Don.
I'll see you, Ed.
Wearing a forced smile, Don Hollenbeck leaves. Morrow stares after him, puffing on a cigarette. Next, Joe Wershberger is among a group of reporters leaving a meeting of the U.S. Senate in Washington, D.C.
Hey, Joe, what's all this Radwitz junk you're putting out?
Don, I can't talk to you right now. I gotta get this film back to New York.
What would you say if I told you that Murrow was on the Soviet payroll in 1935?
Joe turns to his cameraman.
Charlie, you wanna?
Sure, I'll set up outside.
The cameraman throws a concerned glance.
McCarthy going to the Eisenhower dinner?
I have no idea. I'll keep the senator's calendar for him, Joe.
Really?
The suited man hands Joe a folder.
Don, have you seen any spy films? You don't just hand me a classified folder. You're supposed to slip it in my briefcase.
Oh, perfect. I didn't know who to give this information to, Paley or Murrow. As you can imagine, Fred and I aren't very friendly. No pun intended.
Well, no pun elocuted.
What do you got? In short, Murrow's been a communist sympathizer since the 1930s. Member of the International Workers, sponsored educational trips to Moscow and on the Soviet payroll in 1935. It's all there.
You want to know why that's not possible? Why you'll lose this one, Donald? Because everyone in this country knows Admiral is a loyal American. It's a patriot.
Did you know the word gullible isn't in the dictionary, Joe?
Can you get the stamp?
Oh, I'd love it. I have copies.
They stand in a wide corridor near a furled U.S. flag.
You guys go too far.
He walks like a duck and talks like a duck.
The man in the suit, with hands in pockets, watches Joe leave. Murrow waits in the executive suite at CBS.
Yes, Mr. Paley. Right away. Yes, sir. No, he hasn't called. Yes, sir, the second he calls. If you're in a meeting, shall I? Yes, sir. Of course, sir. Mr. Mara, Mr. Paley will see you now.
The dumpy elderly secretary shows Morrow to the inner office.
Mr. Paley, Mr. Morrow is here.
Thank you, Miss Mara.
Hello, Ed.
Bill.
Sit over here, will you? How's Janet? Your son?
Oh, well, thanks. How's Babe?
Oh, she's fine, she's fine. Her fundraiser got rained on, so...
That's why I never plan on any.
Really? You'd never know.
The CBS boss tosses an envelope on a table.
Reading fiction?
I hope so. You tell me.
Well, now we know how they're going to come at us.
That's just their first shot. Somebody's going to go down. Have you checked your facts? Are you sure you're on safe ground?
Bill, it's time. Show our cards.
My cards. You lose, what happens? Five guys find themselves out of work. I'm responsible for a hell of a lot more than five goddamn reporters. Let it go. McCarthy will self-destruct. Cone all of them.
Bill, you said corporate would not interfere with editorial and that the news was to be left to our
own. We don't make the news. We report the news.
99% of the time, he's wrong about the people he's marked as
communists. If he goes too far, the Senate will investigate him, and we will report on that.
But he's wrong 100% of the time when he oversteps people's
civil liberties. And what are you doing? You're trying him in the press. Does he get the right to face his accuser? Ed, you've just decided on this, and now you're presenting it.
What I am doing, Bill...
I write your check. I put you in your country house, and I put your son through school. You should have told me about this before it went so far down the road.
Paley snatches up the envelope, steps away, and throws it down again.
Every one of your boys needs to be clean. Do you understand? No ties. If Aaron's mother so much as went to a group fundraiser in 1932, he's out. Hewitt, too. Anyone in that room, you make no mistake, I will cut them loose. Corporate won't interfere with editorial, but editorial will not jeopardize the hundreds of employees of the Columbia Broadcasting System. Do I make myself clear? Yes.
Looking aggrieved, Morrow leaves the office. Next, Friendly chairs a production meeting.
Fellas, our next show is going to be about Senator McCarthy, and we're going to go right at him. I don't need to tell you how careful we have to be. If we are to do this, then Ed and I need you to be straight with us. We need to know, for the good of the piece, if any of you have any connection at all, if you subscribe to a newsletter, if you attended a party, anything. Anything that could compromise this. Anything at all. Because now would be the time to tell us.
Friendly sits on a desk. Palmer Williams speaks out.
Ed, I think I should excuse myself.
Palmer, kidding
me? My ex was I wouldn't say she was a communist, but she certainly attended meetings. It's before we were married. I didn't even really know about it until after the divorce. It's different then. We're all on the same side. I'm not telling you guys anything you don't know. The thing of it is, somebody will find out. They'll hurt us with it. I should have told you sooner, Ed. I'm sorry. Fred?
Morrow shakes his head.
Oh, none of us had ever read a dangerous book or had a friend who was different or never joined an organization that advocated change. We'd all be just the kind of people Joe McCarthy wants. We're going to go with the story, because the terror is right here in this room.
John, Jesse, go through the HUAC hearings. Eddie, Palmer, look at the interviews and any speeches. Okay, fellas, here we go. His own words. That's what we need.
He said that he wouldn't remove that general from the army who cleared a communist major. I said, then, General, you should be removed from any command. Any man who says, I will protect another general who protects communists is not fit to wear that uniform, General.
All right, so hold on. Ethically, we're fine. But legally, if we air this, aren't we leaking closed hearing testimony?
But he chose to read it.
We're not misquoting him. There are other reporters. I think legally we're on safe.
It's a legal issue. It's his.
I'll check with Campbell and legal.
And wait till you hear the bleeding hearts scream and cry about our methods of trying to drag the truth from those who know or should know who covered up a Fifth Amendment communist major. But they say, oh, it's all right to uncover them, but don't get rough doing it, McCarthy.
Did the Civil Liberties Union provide you with an attorney at that time?
I had many offers of attorneys, and one of those was from the American Civil Liberties Union, yes.
The question is, did the Civil Liberties Union supply you with an attorney?
They did supply an attorney.
The answer is yes?
The answer is yes.
You know, the Civil Liberties Union has been listed as a front for and doing the work of the Communist Party.
Mr. Chairman, this was 1932.
Yeah, I know that's 1932. Do you know that they since have been listed as a front for and doing the work of the Communist Party?
I do not know that they have been listed so, sir.
You don't know they have been listed?
I have heard that mention.
All right, Dale, turn it off.
Stevenson's riding those three kids and Stevenson's tacked on the end.
Have you read this book yet? It would be nice if this guy isn't actually a commie.
Did Millie give it to you?
I want to read the book.
Nobody else.
I hear you, boss.
That's it.
I'll put it on the
end. Palmer, cut it at 2:30.
I prefer it one on each end. Let it run through. I think it'll be more powerful. Really? Cut Kennedy. Short piece.
We got enough.
Go file it for me. I'll see the month piece later.
You're going to make it, Fred?
We lost the telecine, but we'll make it.
With his tie skew with monotypes.
Did you finish your closing piece?
It's Shakespeare.
Right, you're closing.
The production office is empty apart from Murrow typing at his desk with a cigarette between his lips and Friendly, who lounges back in an easy chair. Next, it's morning. Joe and Shirley Washburn get dressed at their home. She stands in the bathroom in her underslip, putting on lipstick.
My argument was, if you just show the images of McCarthy, it doesn't make any difference. If you agree with them, you're going to hate the piece. If you don't, you'll love it.
Maybe they should wait till they get more footage.
I don't think we'd take that chance. We've got to hit McCarthy before he comes after Ed.
The blue one. Well, they haven't gone after the Alsops or her block.
Honey. The Alsops and her block didn't work for the Institute of International Education in 1934.
Then I guess it's time.
She brushes her hair with the bathroom door open. He puts on a tie.
You worry?
I didn't think I was. I don't know why. I was in the office on Friday, and I answered the phone. It was Howard calling from London, and he asked what was going on with McCarthy. And before I answered him, I turned and looked over my shoulder to see who was listening.
And who was listening?
Chairman Mao. Mm-hmm.
She smiles. He puts on a jacket from the wardrobe.
See you at the office.
Hey, your ring.
He does an about turn and removes his wedding ring.
Name me another wife who reminds her husband to take off his wedding ring before he goes to the office.
Ava Gardner.
The caption reads, March the 9th, 1954. Murrow and Friendly are in the TV studio.
Excuse me, Mr. Friendly. Mr. Murrow, Mr. Paley's on the line for you.
Maybe he wants to reimburse us for those ads.
Yeah, you'd like that.
I would like that.
This is Ed.
There's a Knickerbocker game tonight. I've got front row seats. Are you interested?
I'm a little busy bringing down the network tonight, Bill.
Is that tonight?
We're covered, Bill.
All right. I'm with you today, Ed. And I'm with you tomorrow.
Thanks, Bill.
Paley looks calm and reflective as he replaces his phone. Friendly is squatting down beside Murrow, who's about to go on air. The control room clock approaches 10:30.
Do you know the timing on that first?
No, that's
the answer. Can we hold all the calls, please, Simon? Extension. All the calls till after the show. Thank you.
Are you fellas awake down there?
Okay.
Just, what are we, 20?
30 seconds.
Murrow, in a light three-piece suit, does up a button on his jacket. He flexes his muscles as the seconds tick away. He glances at Friendly, who holds a stopwatch.
10 seconds.
Murrow's foot taps nervously on the floor.
5, 4, 3, 2.
And pan camera one.
Murrow looks to the camera with gravitas.
Because a report on Senator McCarthy is by definition controversial, we want to say exactly what we mean to say and request your permission to read from a script whatever remarks Murrow and Friendly may make. If the senator feels that we have done violence to his words or pictures, and desires, so to speak, to answer himself, an opportunity will be afforded him on this program. Our working thesis tonight is this quotation. if this fight against communism has made a fight between America's two great political parties, the American people know that one of these parties will be destroyed, and the Republic cannot endure very long as a one-party system. We applaud that statement, and we think Senator McCarthy ought to. He said it 17 months ago in Milwaukee.
The American people realize that this cannot be made a fight between America's two great political parties. If this fight against communism is made a fight between America's two great political parties, the American people know that one of those parties will be destroyed and the Republic can't endure very long as a one-party system.
On one thing, the senator has been consistent. Often operating as a one-man committee, he has traveled far, interviewed many, terrorized some, accused civilian and military leaders of the past administration of a great conspiracy to turn over the country to communism.
Well, may I say that I was extremely shocked when I heard that Secretary Stevens told two Army officers that they had to take part in the cover-up of those who promoted and coddled communists. As I read his statement, I thought of that quotation, "On what meat doth this our Caesar feed?"
The question is, did the Civil Liberties Union supply you with an attorney?
They did supply an attorney.
The answer is yes?
The answer is yes.
Do you think this book did considerable harm, its publication, by an expression of the views contained in it?
The sale of that book was so abysmally small, it was so unsuccessful, that a question of its influence, really, you can go back to the publisher, you'll see it was one of the most unsuccessful books he ever put out. He's still sorry about it, just as I am.
Well, I think that's a compliment to American intelligence. Say that.
The Reed-Harris hearing demonstrates one of the senator's techniques. Twice, he said, the American Civil Liberties Union was listed as a subversive front. The Attorney General's list does not and never has listed the ACLU as subversive, nor does the FBI or any other federal government agency. And the American Civil Liberties Union holds in its files letters of commendation from President Truman, President Eisenhower, and General MacArthur. Earlier, the senator asked, upon what meat does this our Caesar feed? Had he looked three lines earlier in Shakespeare's Caesar, he would have found this line, which is not altogether inappropriate. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. No one familiar with the history of this country can deny that congressional committees are useful. It is necessary to investigate before legislating, but the line between investigating and persecuting is a very fine one, and the junior senator from Wisconsin has stepped over it repeatedly. We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law. We will not walk in fear one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason if we dig deep in our history and our doctrine, and remember that we are not descended from fearful men, not from men who feared to write, to associate, to speak, and to defend the causes that were for the moment unpopular. This is no time for men who oppose Senator McCarthy's methods to keep silent, or for those who approve. We can deny our heritage and our history, but we cannot escape responsibility for the results. We proclaim ourselves, indeed, as we are, the defenders of freedom wherever it continues to exist in the world, but we cannot defend freedom abroad by deserting it at home. The actions of the junior senator from Wisconsin have caused alarm and dismay amongst our allies abroad and given considerable comfort to our enemies. And whose fault is that? Not really his. He didn't create this situation of fear. He merely exploited it, and rather successfully. Cassius was right. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. Good night, and good luck.
We're out.
In the studio, Friendly gets to his feet. He and Murrow stare at the silent black telephone on the desk.
Nothing? Well, maybe nobody watched.
Friendly looks through the glass into the control room.
We got nothing.
I don't know.
Nothing.
Should I turn the phones back on, Mr. Williams?
They stare in bemusement.
Yes, I mean, that would be a good time for that.
Turn the phones on! Turn the phones!
Turn the phones right on. Mr. Friendly wants the phones on.
Yes, the junior senator calling collect.
Don't kid yourself. It's Reed Harris thanking us for putting on the bestseller.
I don't know whether all of you have seen what I just saw, but I want to associate myself and this program with what Ed Murrow has just said, and say I've never been prouder of CBS.
They applaud the endorsement by CBS News anchor Don Hollenbeck. Joe exchanges a furtive glance with his wife Shirley. William Paley sits stiffly and alone at his executive desk with the TV monitor on, ignoring the phone. His face is impassive. Back in the control room...
Great show.
Good work.
Feel like a scotch.
I think everybody could use a scotch.
Murrow looks exhausted. They retire to the bar.
You're driving me crazy. What did I do? What did I do? My tears for you make everything hazy, a cloud in the sky of blue. How true were the friends who were near me to cheer me, believe me they knew. But you were the one who would hurt me, desert me when I needed you. Oh, you, you're driving me crazy. What did I do to you?
Early editions are out.
I'm not worried about that.
No, of course not.
Shirley, honey,
you go across the street and get the early editions.
All of them?
Just get O'Brien.
Hey, watch my drink. Yeah.
Shirley leaves, followed by Joe, who is a little unsteady on his feet. The team sit in clusters, smoking and sipping their drinks, like weary warriors who've won the first battle. Newscaster Don Hollenbeck has joined them. They all wait in pensive silence for the newspapers to arrive. All eyes are on Joe and Shirley as they breeze in, each clutching first editions.
Okay, here we go. The Times.
Right on time. Good. Who wrote it?
Jekyll. Edward R. Murrow's television program on Senator Joseph R. McCarthy was an exciting and provocative examination of the man and his methods. It was crusading journalism of high responsibility and courage for TV so often plagued by timidity and hesitation. The program was a milestone that reflected enlightened citizenship. The program, hold on. The program was no less an indictment of those who wish the problems posed by the center's tactics and theatrics would just go away and leave them alone. Mm-hmm. That was Mr. Murrow's and television's triumph, and a very great one.
Here, here. Yeah, what's his beef? Send the New York Times a bottle of scotch.
I already did. How do you think we got that review?
How's the post?
It's pretty good.
What about O'Brien?
The same.
Go on. Read O'Brien.
I don't have it. Here we go.
Surely that.
We can't say we were surprised at Edward R. Murrow's Hate McCarthy telecast last evening when his explosively one-sided propaganda, edited with deviously clever selectivity from McCarthy's march against communism, was finished last evening. By equally Machiavellian coincidence, the following telecast featured Murrow's PM protege, Hollenbeck, in an obviously gloating mood. Hollenbeck hoped viewers had witnessed his patron's triumph from and for the left. So on.
Shirley, it's okay. Go ahead, finish it.
No, that's it. It's
Shirley,
that's it.
Please. Finish it.
Hollenbeck forces a smile.
The Columbia Broadcasting System has been in a lengthy, clean house of lefties mood. The worst offenders on lesser levels have been quietly pushed out of the company. Don Hollenbeck, a graduate of the demised Pinko publication PM, attacked conservative papers with sly and slanted propaganda. He then proceeded through an equally tilted review of the day's events with McCarthy dominating his words, actions, attitudes, so on.
Murrow throws a concerned glance at Hollenbeck.
It's a wine.
Yeah, we need to get the scotch, that's all.
Grammatically correct.
I'll have that cigarette, Ed.
Thanks, Shirley.
Thank you. Joe? Shirley? Mm. Really work.
Friendly pats Hollenbeck.
It doesn't matter.
Hollenbeck looks close to tears as he clinks his glass.
To Jekyll.
To Jack Gould.
A real
writer.
Next morning, Friendly takes the lift.
Hello, Jimmy.
Fred, congratulations.
Thank you. You got a hangover you wouldn't believe.
All the bad guys on the third floor watched the show.
We got a good review in the New York Times.
Switchboard lit up all night. We're putting out a press release that said the calls came in 15 to 1 in favor of the show.
Really?
Yeah. 15 to 1. We got calls from everywhere.
East Coast or the West
Coast? Yeah, Kansas City, Cincinnati. Mr. Paley.
Morning, Fred.
Morning, Mr. Paley.
As Jimmy gets out, Paley gets into the lift.
How's your wife?
She's fine. Getting ready to move.
Really? Where to?
Riverdale. We found a nice house.
It's nice there.
Yes, sir. Excuse me.
Fred, McCarthy wants William Buckley to do his rebuttal. I said no.
Yes, sir.
Paley remains in the lift as Friendly gets out. Now the newsroom.
Hey, Johnny. Radulovich has been reinstated.
What?
Radulovich! Guys, Radulovich has been reinstated.
Jesse!
Where is that?
Where is that?
What?
Jess!
It's got some good news. It's got some very good news. Special announcement from the Secretary of the Air Force. Fellas, listen up, everyone. I have decided that it is consistent with the interest of the national security to retain Lieutenant Radulovich in the United States Air Force. Stop! He is not, in my opinion, a security risk. Full stop! There you go. Harold E. Talbot, Secretary from the Air Force.
Congratulations.
Great job.
Jesse, make a copy of that for me, will you?
I will do, Fred.
Good
job, Don.
And you know this means something.
Good news, huh?
This absolutely means something.
Absolutely.
Murrow allows himself a smile. Now he sits at a typewriter. Friendly drops an envelope on his desk and on Palmer Williams' desk.
Palmer. The CBS lawyers want to talk to you.
When?
Tomorrow. I don't want you to get paranoid. They're talking to everybody.
Any ideas?
Just tell them what you know.
Now, is that testimony true? No, sir, it is not. Not of any time have I been a member of a Communist Party, and I have never seen a Communist car.
You've never seen a Communist car?
That's right.
Have you ever attended any Communist meeting?
No, sir, I've never attended any Communist meeting.
Have you ever subscribed to the Daily Worker?
No, sir, I didn't subscribe for the Daily Worker, and I wouldn't pay for it.
The viewing room.
Mrs. Marquard, who was working for the FBI, who joined the Communist Party under orders from the FBI, has testified that while she never met you personally at a communist meeting, that your name was on the list of communists who were paying dues. Can you shed any light upon that?
No, sir. I don't even know what the dues are or where they were paid.
Do you understand you have never paid any money to the Communist Party? Is that correct?
That's right.
You've never paid any dues to anyone?
Thank you very much.
Good work, Joe. Charlie, yep. Now what is the show? Is it defending Annie Lee Moss as not being a communist, or is it her constitutional rights?
Cool.
I think we're much better sticking off with constitutional issues.
The world is not a communist spy.
Joe McCarthy said that they have a spy in the Pentagon, that spy has gotten into the code room, and that spy is Annie Lee Moss.
I've got New York Times reports. McCarthy asserts he has a new red link to Army. Quote, Senator McCarthy charged today that the Army now employs a woman in its code room who was and still may be an active communist, unquote.
It's front page of the New York Times.
You know, sooner is he done chastising the other committee members for wanting to push it to the afternoon, then what, seven questions in?
Right.
He ducks out.
He leaves.
It's all over the headlines, all over the country.
Yes. Can you get me copies from any newspaper that printed anything about that assertion?
Absolutely. That's a good idea. You should get it from Cincinnati Inquirer, all across the country.
Chicago.
You have a stash in there for the show.
A couple other pieces I think we should include. The fact there's three Annie Lee Mosses in the phone book. There are two Robert Halls. One's colored, one's white.
Charlie said we have some footage of the empty chair. I think that says it all, just that picture.
That's a great
McCarthy
shot.
McCarthy nod, cutting
the headlines. McCarthy's leaving the hearing after seven questions, and then we'll cut to the shot of the chair.
We gotta do something about it.
All right, so to that end.
Wait, excuse me, fellas. Mr. Murrow, McCarthy wants April 6th.
Mario freezes.
Thank you, Natalie.
Fine. If Charlie shoots it, we get to see it first. We should ask. We should offer. It's a long
shot.
What
the hell can McCarthy possibly do? Is he going to debate himself? We just used his words.
Johnny, we know what it's going to be. He's going to come after me. There's nothing more he can do. He's going to bet that a senator trumps a newsman.
He'll lose.
Not if we're playing bridge.
Oh, I'm sorry, guys. Didn't mean to interrupt.
Hey, Don.
Always getting it on now.
Ed, you have a minute?
Yes, Don, I'll be right there.
All right, boys. All right, playtime's over. We have 4 days. We need 28 to show.
Yeah. All right. Oh, that's all right. Go ahead.
Hi, Mary. Mr. Hollenbeck.
Could you give us a moment, please, dear?
Certainly.
He leads Morrow into the makeup room.
I have to ask you something, Ed. It's about O'Brien.
O'Brien doesn't matter, Don.
He's killing me, Ed.
It doesn't amount to a hell of a lot.
No,
in the
news. It's not just him, Ed. We ought to let
We're
that
not
guy
going
have
after
it.
O'Brien, Don. I will not take on McCarthy and Hearst. I can't defeat them both. Just don't read the papers. Or don't read O'Brien, anyway.
The two men lock eyes across the room.
Okay. I guess not.
Sorry, Don.
Morrow leaves Hollenbeck standing alone with a haggard expression and a haunted look in his eyes. As voiceovers are recorded for the next TV show, footage comes in of Mrs. Moss's McCarthy interrogation.
Although Miss Moss offered to testify,
Senator Munt, South
Senator
Dakota.
McCarthy suggested that she was too sick. She agreed.
Mr. Cohn
and that
wanted to know
morning.
About Mrs. Moss's question.
Very much.
Did you solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, self you got?
May we get your full name for the record, please?
Annie Lee Moss.
M-O-S-S.
That's right.
Mrs. Moss, let me say for the record and for your information, for the information of your counsel, that you are not here because you are considered important in the communist apparatus. We have the testimony that you are have been a communist. We are rather curious, however, to know that how you suddenly were shifted from a worker in a cafeteria to the Codro. In other words, I am today much more interested in the handling of your case by your superiors and in your own personal activities. However, counsel will question you about your own activities also.
Mr. Chairman.
We will not hear from counsel. You've been told what the rule is. If you have anything to say, say it through your client.
Chairman, did you begin work at the General Accounting Office in 1945?
Yes, sir.
And prior to that time, had you been a cafeteria worker?
Yes, I have.
I see. While in the Pentagon since 1950, have you had any connection with coded messages? Have you ever handled coded messages?
No more than to transmit them.
Pardon me?
No more than to transmit the messages.
Than to transmit them? Did you transmit
Receive coded? Or to transmit messages was all I had to do. And then the courtroom, I've never been into a courtroom in my life.
Do you know the type of classification? Do you know if they were secret, top secret, confidential?
No, sir.
In other words, you wouldn't know the degree of classification?
No, sir.
I see. I'm afraid I'm going to have to excuse myself. I've got a rather important appointment tonight, which I've got to work on right now, and I wonder if Senator Munt, you would take over as chairman?
Chairman, I have no further questions of this witness at this time. To say that we have the testimony of Mrs. Marquardt, the undercover agent of the FBI, stating that Annie Lee Moss was a member, a dues-paying member of the Communist Party, the Northeast Club of the Communist Party. We have corroboration of that testimony by another witness who was called before the committee and gave a sworn statement to the effect that she also knew Mrs. Moss as a member of the Northeast Club of the Communist
Party. She's already lost her job. She's been suspended because of this action. I'm not defending her. If she's a communist, I want her exposed. But to make these statements, is we've got corroborating evidence that she is a communist. Under these circumstances, I think she's entitled to have it produced here in her presence and let the public know about it and let her know about it. I don't like to try people by hearsay evidence. I like to get the witnesses here and try them. my testimony under oath.
The chair will rule that the comment of Mr. Cohen be stricken from the record.
Well, I didn't ask that. I didn't ask that, Mr. Chairman.
Whether we should try to produce a witness in public because the FBI may have her undercover. We don't want to.
But you can't strike these statements made by counsel here as the evidence that we're having and withholding. You cannot strike that from the press nor from the public mind once it's planted there. That is the evil of it. Well, I don't think it's fair to a witness, to a citizen of this country, to bring them up here and cross-examine them. Then when they get through, say, we've got something, the FBI has got something on you that condemns you.
The chair agrees.
It is not sworn testimony. It's convicting people by rumor and hearsay and innuendo.
You will notice that neither Senator McClellan or Senator Symington, nor this reporter, know or claim that Mrs. Moss was or is a communist. Their claim was simply that she had the right to meet her accusers face to face.
The caption says April the 6th, 1954. Now Murrow sits smoking at his typewriter. He looks anguished and searching for inspiration. He checks his watch and whips the paper from the typewriter.
1 month ago tonight, we presented a report on Senator Joseph R. McCarthy. We labeled it as controversial. Most of that report consisted of words and pictures of the senator. At that time, we said, if the senator believes we have done violence to his words or pictures, if he desires to speak, to answer himself, an opportunity would be afforded him on this program. The senator sought the opportunity, asked for a delay of 3 weeks because he said he was very busy and he wished adequate time to prepare his reply. We agreed. We placed no restrictions on the manner or method of the presentation of his reply, and we suggested that we would not take time to comment on this particular program. Here now is Senator Joseph R. McCarthy, junior senator from Wisconsin.
Good evening. Mr. Edward R. Murrow, educational director of the Columbia Broadcasting System, devoted his program to an attack on the work of the United States Senate Investigating Committee and on me personally as its chairman. Now, over the past 4 years, he has made repeated attacks upon me and those fighting communists. Now, of course, neither Joe McCarthy nor Edward R. Murrow is of any great importance as individuals. We are only important in our relation to the great struggle to preserve our American liberties. Now, ordinarily, I would not take time out from the important work at hand to answer Murrow. However, in this case, I feel justified in doing so because Murrow is the symbol, the leader, and the cleverest of the jackal pack which is always found at the throat of anyone who dares to expose individual communists and traitors. And I am compelled by the facts to say to you that Mr. Edward R. Murrow, as far back as 20 years ago, was engaged in propaganda for communist causes. For example, the Institute of International Education, of which he was the acting director, was chosen to act as a representative by a Soviet agency to do a job which would normally be done by the Russian secret police. Now, Mr. Murrow, by his own admission, was a member of the IWW, that's the Industrial Workers of the World, a terrorist organization cited as subversive by an attorney general of the United States. Now, Mr. Murrow said on this program, and I quote, he said, the actions of the junior senator from Wisconsin have given considerable comfort to the enemy. That is the language of our statute of treason, rather strong language. If I am giving comfort to our enemies, I ought not to be in the Senate. If, on the other hand, Mr. Murrow is giving comfort to our enemies, he ought not to be brought into the homes of millions of Americans by the Columbia Broadcasting System. And I want to assure you that I will not be deterred by the attacks of the Murrows, the Lattimores, the Fosters, the Daily Worker, or the Communist Party itself. Now, I make no claim to leadership. In complete humility, I do ask you and every American who loves this country to join with me.
William Paley, wearing a dinner jacket and a black bow tie, tosses his overcoat over a railing and strolls slowly into the now deserted and darkened control room. He glances reflectively at the equipment and the banks of passive monitors. Now a TV commercial. A caption says, Alcoa.
Everyone talks about the weather. Wherever you look on America's modern farms, aluminum is on the job, helping the farmer do something about the weather. Aluminum for the farm is one more example of how Alcoa, since 1888, has continued to pioneer new uses for this vital metal. New uses of aluminum that mean better farms and better farming. The aluminum from the nation's first and leading producer, Alcoa, Aluminum Company of America.
Last week, Senator McCarthy appeared on this program to correct any errors he might have thought we made in our report of March 9th. Since he made no reference to any statements of fact that we made, we must conclude that he found no errors of fact. He proved again that anyone who exposes him, anyone who does not share his hysterical disregard for decency and human dignity and the rights guaranteed by the Constitution, must be either a communist or a fellow traveler. I fully expected this treatment. The senator added this reporter's name to a long list of individuals and institutions he has accused of serving the communist cause. His proposition is very simple. Anyone who criticizes or opposes Senator McCarthy's methods must be a communist. And if that be true, there are an awful lot of communists in this country. For the record, let's consider briefly some of the senator's charges. He claimed, but offered no proof, that I had been a member of the industrial workers of the world. That is false. I was never a member of the IWW, never applied for membership. The senator charged that Professor Harold Lasky, a British scholar and politician, dedicated a book to me. That's true. He is dead. He was a socialist. I am not. He was one of those civilized individuals who did not insist upon agreement with his political principles as a precondition for conversation or friendship. I do not agree with his political ideas. Lasky, as he makes clear in the introduction, dedicated the book to me not because of political agreement, but because he held my wartime broadcast from London in high regard, and the dedication so reads. I believed 20 years ago, and I believe today, that mature Americans can engage in conversation and controversy, the clash of ideas, with communists anywhere in the world without becoming contaminated or converted. I believe that our faith, our conviction, our determination are stronger than theirs, and that we can compete and successfully, not only in the area of bombs, but in the area of ideas. I have worked with CBS for more than 19 years. The company has subscribed fully to my integrity and responsibility as a broadcaster and as a loyal American. I require no lectures from the junior senator from Wisconsin as to the dangers or terrors of communism. Having searched my conscience and my files, I cannot contend that I have always been right or wise, but I have attempted to pursue the truth with some diligence and to report it, even though, as in this case, I had been warned in advance that I would be subjected to the attentions of Senator McCarthy. We shall hope to deal with matters of more vital interest to the country next week. Good night and good luck.
The studio lights fade on a close-up of Murrow's face. In the office next day, one of the team reads from a newspaper.
In the last analysis, the senator was perched on the television high dive and all prepared to make a resounding splash. He jumped beautifully, but he neglected to check first where he was going to land. It must have been something of a shock to discover that Mr. Murrow had drained the water out of the pool.
Is that the Times?
Yeah, Gould? It's Jack Gould at the Times.
Well, he's a hell of a writer.
Yes, he is a hell of a writer. We can afford him.
Stanton's got a public
appearance. The Senate's investigating McCarthy. What? The Army's charging that McCarthy and Cohn exercise undue pressure to get preferential treatment for Shine. Let's talk Crichton down to Sun.
Do you have a second source?
There's not a second source, but this is coming out on the wire in 2 hours.
Who's heading up the investigation?
Well, it's not going to be McCarthy.
Are you really?
Call somebody at the Washington Post.
Yeah, a second source.
Hey, it's Palmer Williams for Jack Thompson.
The Senate's investigating McCarthy.
There's an added bit of comedy to this whole story. The committee cannot convene for several days because Senator McCarthy has a slight case of laryngitis. Aww. And he must recover in the air. But Stevens is going after him, and it looks like Joe Welch. They're going to allow each side to call witnesses and be privy to other testimony.
Hey, Fred, we still have a meeting when I get back. We're going to go talk to Thompson.
Friendly's on the phone.
No, thanks, Jack.
Okay. Oh, Freddy, we're ahead. Right up there with howdy doody, huh?
With a grim face, Friendly whispers into Morrow's ear. The smile disappears from Morrow's face. Both men look shocked and sad.
1, 2, 7, 6.
Somewhere there's music. How faint the tune.
The fact of newscaster Don Hollenbeck's suicide yesterday does not remove from the record the peculiar history of the leftist slanting of the news indulged consistently by the Columbia Broadcasting System. Hollenbeck was what most astute students of CBS's strange and questionable new methods considered typical of its newscasters. By Jack O'Brien.
In a flashback, Don Hollenbeck sits in his apartment in front of his TV. The door to the gas oven is open. The gas is switched on, but not lit. Hollenbeck wears the expression of a broken man.
You love me as I love you. Somewhere.
Ed Morrow walks slowly to the control room. Through the glass, he sees the jazz singer rehearsing with her band. The studio clock says 10 to 9. With sadness etched on his face, he takes a seat.
Somewhere this heaven.
Friendly slowly paces in the production office with his hand to his head. Others stare at him in stunned shock, as if trying to seek answers. Morrow rests his chin on his hand. A cigarette burns between his fingers. His eyes are fixed with a faraway stare. His face is pained.
Until you will, how still my heart, how high the moon.
One of the best programs I ever heard was called CBS Views the Press. A great many people liked it, some didn't, but no one ever called it anything but honest. It was the work of an honest reporter, Don Hollenbeck. He also worked occasionally on See It Now. He did the 11 p.m. news over some of these stations. He had been sick lately, and he died this morning. The police said it was suicide, gas. Not much of an obit. But at least we got our facts straight, and it was brief. And that's all Don Hollenbeck would have asked. Good night, and good luck.
The CBS logo. Next, Shirley and Joe lie in bed.
Get me to Philadelphia this morning.
What time is your train?
8.
Charlie going with you?
Mm-hmm.
They lie on their backs in the darkened room, staring towards the ceiling.
Is that what if we're wrong?
We're not wrong.
I'm not gonna look back and say we protected the wrong side.
Protected them from what? In the name of what would we be preserving?
An argument. Made for the greater good.
No, once you give it all away, it's no good then.
It's just a thought.
A caption on a TV monitor says Army McCarthy hearings.
Senator, may we not drop this? We know he belongs to the Lawyers Guild. And Mr. Cole nods his head at me. I did you, I think, no personal injury, Mr. Cole.
No, sir.
I meant to do you no personal injury. And if I did, I beg your pardon. Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator. You've done enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?
I know this hurts you, Mr. Welch.
Senator, I think it hurts you too, sir.
I'd like to finish this.
Have you some private reservation when you take the oath that you will tell the whole truth that lets you be the judge of what you will testify to?
The answer is there's no reservation about telling the whole truth.
Thank you, sir.
Yes.
Then tell us who delivered the document to you.
This new fashion is not chic. I think it's just not good for me.
Not for you. Milko, anything you care to say on that subject?
I think no comment.
Frank Stanton walks into the newsroom where Shirley is on the phone.
Check again. Charlie said he dropped it off.
Shirley?
He dropped it.
Can I see you a minute?
I gotta call you back.
Joe? You too.
Joe and Shirley exchange a puzzled glance before getting to their feet to follow Stanton into a sound booth.
Close the door. Have a seat.
Yeah.
How are you?
Fine, thank you.
You both are aware that there's a policy here at CBS that no two employees can be married. I want to ask you both a question, but I don't want you to answer it. I want you to just consider it. I know you two are married. Everyone knows. That's not my question. In the next few weeks, I have to lay off a couple of people. We're making some significant cuts across the board. I wanted you to know that. Because you could save someone else being fired. I'm asking you to consider making this decision a little easier. I don't need an answer now. Just think about it. Okay.
He leaves the couple sitting like naughty children. Joe turns to make sure he's out of earshot. Shirley affectionately bumps her shoulder into Joe's.
Well, sure gonna miss you around here.
Yeah, I'll pack my things.
She unclips her wedding ring from a necklace under her top.
I think it's for the best.
Well, we'll find out.
He puts his ring on.
Ms. Worshipper. Everybody knew.
They smile and embrace as they leave. Murrow strolls through the corridor to the executive suite.
Natalie, did he say what it was about?
No, Mr. Murray, just that he wanted to talk to you in his office.
He sees Friendly also waiting. Friendly gestures that he doesn't know what it's about either. Friendly sits holding a folder under a modern art painting. They exchange a comfortable glance, and Murrow sits down beside him.
Uh-oh.
The problem isn't simply that you've lost your sponsor. With Alcoa, see it now, still loses
Mr.
money.
Mr. Paley, he is $50,000. Last week's episode we did for less than
$50,000. Fred, you're speaking beyond your competence.
We'll find another sponsor. We can certainly find someone who wants
$64,000 question brings in over 80,000 in sponsors, and it costs one-third of what you do. Ed, I've got Tuesday night programming that's number one. People want to enjoy themselves. They don't want a civics lesson.
What do you want, Bill?
I don't
want
to get a constant stomachache every time you take on a controversial subject.
I'm afraid that's the price you have to be willing to pay.
Let's walk very carefully through these next few moments.
The content of what we're doing is more important than what some guy in Cincinnati...
What you're doing, Ed, not me, not Frank Stanton, you.
CBS News, see it now. All belong to you, Bill.
You wouldn't know it.
What is it you want? Credit?
I never censored a single program. I hold on to affiliates who wanted entertainment from us. I fight to keep the license with the very same politicians that you were bringing down. And I never, never said no to you. Never.
I would argue that we have done very well by one another. I would argue that this network is defined by what the news department has accomplished. And I would also argue that never saying no is not the same as not censoring.
Really? You should teach journalism. You and Mr. Friendly.
Paley sits back in his chair. He looks ill at ease.
Let me ask you this. Why didn't you correct McCarthy when he said that Alger Hiss was convicted of treason? He was only convicted of perjury. You corrected everything else. Did you not want the appearance of defending a known communist? I would argue that everyone censors, including you.
What do you want to do, Bill?
I'm taking your program from a half an hour to an hour. And it won't be a weekly program, and it won't be Tuesday nights.
When would it be?
Sunday afternoons.
How many episodes?
Five.
Why don't you just fire me, Bill?
I don't think it's what either of us wants. You owe me five shows.
Morrow stubs his cigarette in an ashtray on the executive desk. He and Friendly get to their feet.
You won't like the subject matter.
Probably not. Fred, I'll need you for a moment.
Friendly walks back from the door. Morrow waits in the corridor outside the inner sanctum.
Thank you, Mary.
You're welcome, Mr. Friendly.
Friendly blows air through his mouth as he walks towards Morrow.
He wants me to lay a few people off. I'm sure he does. Let's do our first show about the downfall of television.
Morrow gives a wry half-smile.
Senate's going to vote to censor McCarthy tomorrow. Probably. And then what happens? He sits in the back row. Right. They keep him in the Senate. They don't kick him out. No, he stays.
They hold each other's gaze in the wide corridor of executive offices.
Well, we might as well go down swinging. Did you know the most trusted man in America is Milton Berle? See? You should have worn a dress.
They're more sophisticated.
How does the Scotch sound?
We love America.
Scotch sounds good.
Why are we proud?
Did you know Joe and Shirley were married?
True.
We are proud, first of all, because from the beginning of this nation, a man can walk upright.
President Eisenhower on a wall monitor.
No matter who he is or who she is, he can walk upright and meet his friend or his enemy. And he does not fear, but because that enemy may be a position in great power, that he can be suddenly thrown in jail to rot there without charges and with no recourse to justice. We have the Habeas Corpus Act, and we respect it.
I began by saying that our history will be what we make it. If we go on as we are, then history will take its revenge and retribution will not limp in catching up with us. Just once in a while, let us exalt the importance of ideas and information. Let us dream to the extent of saying that on a given Sunday night, the time normally occupied by Ed Sullivan is given over to a clinical survey on the state of American education. And a week or two later, the time normally used by Steve Allen is devoted to a thoroughgoing study of American policy in the Middle East. Would the corporate image of their respective sponsors be damaged? Would the shareholders rise up in their wrath and complain? Would anything happen other than a few million people would have received a little illumination on subjects that may well determine the future of this country and therefore the future of the corporations? To those who say people wouldn't look, they wouldn't be interested, they're too complacent, indifferent, and insulated, I can only reply, there is, in one reporter's opinion, considerable evidence against that contention. But even if they are right, what have they got to lose? Because if they are right, and this instrument is good for nothing but to entertain, amuse, and insulate, then the tube is flickering now, and we will soon see that the whole struggle is lost. This instrument can teach, it can illuminate, and yes, it can even inspire. But it can do so only to the extent that humans are determined to use it towards those ends. Otherwise, it is merely wires and lights in a box. Good night, and good luck.
quarter to three. There's no one in the place.